Hello, friends. My name is Corey. I'm an alcoholic.
Corey.
I'm going to do my best to hold my composure. I'm already getting choked up. It's an honor and a privilege to be here before all of you and to be sober today. A little bit about myself. I was introduced to this program at a very early age. 1985, I turned 15 and went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I knew then that I had a problem. Was able to get a little bit of a grasp on recovery back then. Even though I was the next closest person in my age was 27 years old, I was able to get a grasp of recovery because my sponsor, he was active in service work. He didn't really take me through the steps. I went up to my step four, never completed it, but he pushed me into service. You know, I showed up at my first meeting. I started emptying ashtrays, started making coffee. You know, they forced me into a GSR position, and then I ended up getting an ASR position, and just so on and so on. And I just coattailed on everybody else's recovery back then. I'd reach out and help the next guys. You know, there was starting to be some younger people starting to come around at that time. Alcoholics Anonymous really didn't have that many young people in it. It was like Narcotics Anonymous was starting to take off, and so that kind of, I steered in that direction back in those days. But I got to learn a little bit about what this program's about and what this fellowship does and how we can recover and how we can help each other. I was able to pick up a 5-year chip, but being a youngster back then, I still couldn't identify with a lot of the things that I was hearing all the older guys talk about in the rooms. You know, I was hearing about jails and divorce and DUIs and all these different things, and I was like, I haven't even experienced any of that. So I had reservations. So after my 5-year, picking up my 5-year chip, I went back out. Unfortunately, it took me 32 years to make it back to the rooms. I'm fortunate enough to not have physically hurt anybody during that time or to physically hurt myself during those years. I did destroy myself physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, along with just about everybody else that was involved with me. I had a soul sickness. I had a hole in my soul that I could not fill. I used drugs and alcohol, I used people, I used sex. Whatever I could get from you to try to fill what was missing inside of me is how I lived my life. I learned a few principles back then, and it kept me as like, okay, as long as I'm not living behind a dumpster, I'm not that guy. I don't need to go back to AA or NA, or I don't need to go back into recovery. As long as I maintain a job, as long as I put food on the table and I provide for my family, which I married women with children. I never had children of my own. God didn't want any more of this shit on this planet. So I married two different times. My first wife had a little boy. He was 3 years old. And I was in that relationship for 8 years. And when that relationship came to an end, that little boy wanted to go with me. And I had no recourse in that situation. It's like, bud, you can't. Your dad still pays child support, and your mother's not going to let me take you with me. So when that relationship ended, my drinking got progressively worse. That hole that it was somewhat filled within that family environment at the time was no longer there. So then I just started boozing even harder and harder. So at an early age, I became a licensed contractor. Was able to make some money, thought I was successful. Through alcoholism and two DUIs, that one business went under because I had to go to jail and serve some time for my wrongdoings. Still thinking I was in control of everything. Went out, did it again, started another business. Still not willing to admit that I have a true problem with this. I thought I had the control over this thing. I was still trying to fill my hole, trying to fix my soul sickness. whatever I did, I could not achieve that. So that went on for several years. Four DUIs later, several sentences later, two failed marriages, four kids that I was involved with. I was about 50% maintaining a relationship with those children. So being a stepdad and having a 50-50 batting average, I thought I did okay. Now those kids are having kids of their own and doing their own thing. So at an early age, just before we'll skip back to my youth. I remember having a soul sickness. When Sergio said, think back to that six-year-old child, I went back to that six-year-old child, and that child was lost. I came from a dysfunctional family. I lived in a home that all I can remember is that no matter what, I wanted to spend every single second away from my house. I don't know why or how. I just didn't want to be home. I didn't feel comfortable, not only in my own skin, but also in my house. So when I went back and was thinking about that child, and he's like, would you tell that child everything would be okay? Today I would, but a year ago I wouldn't be able to say that. My story was like this. I tried to fit and create all these illusions of who I was to create a facade of who I thought you needed to see me be, if that makes any sense. Putting on all these masks, putting all these layers on, you know, whether it be being in a motorcycle club or playing in a rock and roll band or being this or being that or thinking that I'm a badass or whatever. All these different masks, nothing seemed to work. So we'll speed this up. Two failed marriages. Let's see, 2013, I got divorced off of my last marriage. Basically took an early retirement, started just playing music and fucking around in a hobby shop, building motorcycles and playing rock and roll music. Did that for a few years, and then I met my first spiritual teacher, and this happened to be a woman that I ended up falling in love with. And I, even to this day, I still refer to her as my goddess. She was my first spiritual teacher. And she started to be on a path of a quest to find connection to something greater than myself. Still to this day, I do have a power greater than myself. I don't refer to him as God or Jesus. I believe in the universe. I believe in the great creator. I believe in Mother Nature. I believe in a lot of things, and it's all greater powers than myself. I had a game plan. I was gonna go on this spiritual journey at some point and go try to find myself. So basically it boils down to, I went from 5,000 square foot house down into a 600 square foot cabin. Then I sold everything I had and moved into my backpack, and I had no idea where I was going or what I was going to do. I just needed to go try to find something that will fill this hole inside of me. So prior to COVID, I said goodbye to my family. This is back in northern Utah. That's where I'm from. And I left, and I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, where I was going to go, just trusting that something would happen, that I may find the key somewhere. My first stop, I stopped in an ashram upstate New York, and I ended up doing a service commitment up there. And it started my path in the yoga life and becoming a yogi. And I stayed there for a year and a half. And basically took on responsibilities like a construction coordinator, this or that, in doing service for my room and board, still trying to find connection to God or trying to study all these different entities and deities and all these different ways to get to God or source or whatever you call it. The whole time I still had weed stashed in the trailer where I was staying, and then I was still sneaking out and going to the liquor store and still dabbling with my addictions and not admitting that I still had a problem. So needless to say, none of that truly stuck. I mean, some of those facets are still part of my spiritual makeup today. Ended up breaking ties and leaving that organization. And then I found a shaman medicine man that was close by that was teaching shamanism and teaching, you know, plant medicine ceremonies and trying to connect that direction. So I also, I tried that. You know, still trying to connect to source, trying to find something that's going to fill this void inside of my body, inside of my soul, inside of my mind. Why don't I feel okay inside my skin? Sat with them. I sat at that location for about a year, did the same kind of a work exchange kind of program, built a few yurts and a water purification system for that community, and learned quite a bit, but still was empty. Met a few people up in New York that had some properties down here in Florida, and they said that they couldn't trust any of the contractors down here, and they asked me if I would come down and do some work. And this was a year ago, last January, that I came to Florida. And still trying to be of service, trying to find my path, trying to do these things. I come down to Florida. I do all this service work, trying to be of service to others, but still trying to fill my niche. And I realized that I was trying to be of service with an empty vessel, and I depleted myself down to the lowest point that I've ever been in my life. And I had a loaded shotgun, and I stuck it in my mouth, and I was ready to end my life. I was done. The pain, like the people, like a couple of guys have talked about this weekend, I couldn't handle the pain. I needed to kill the pain. I didn't know where it was coming from, how to get rid of it. And the only thing I could think of is my friend Dana that I was doing the work for in her father's condo, if she was to come and walk into that condo and see my brains blown all over the wall. And that's the only reason I didn't pull the trigger. So then my drinking still commenced. I started drinking even heavier. 217 days ago, I woke up and I was like, I was beaten into submission finally. After 32 years out there trying to control this thing, I knew that I was done, that I could not do anymore. I couldn't drink anymore. I couldn't drug anymore. I couldn't use any more women. I couldn't try to find my happiness through medicine men, shaman, different things. Just nothing was working. And I just started crying, and I prayed to whatever was out there, what do I need to do to end this pain without ending my life? And it came right to me. It was like, call Alcoholics Anonymous. Go to a meeting. So the first thing I did is I called a couple sober living houses. I needed to get out of the condo that I was staying in, because it was just, the energy was killing me. I needed to finish up the job, but it was depressing, and I needed to get out of that environment. Plus, I needed to commit to some kind of recovery. So I was reaching out to a recovery house that would drug test and hold all the stipulations that I would need to start my path into recovery. Like I said, that was 217 days ago. And I haven't had the compulsion to use again. I was beaten into submission, and I surrendered. That's what happened for me. I knew that I, with nothing in my control, would kill the pain, help me, and that I had to work on the things that were keeping me sick. And it was me trying to manipulate the situations, whether it be people, places, or things, to fill this void inside of me. And I knew that this was it. Because even prior to coming here, I went off and did some other work with some different men's groups. Some pretty deep spiritual things, but I wasn't dealing with my alcoholism and my addictions. You know, I'm an addict, I'm an asshole, I'm addicted to whatever the hell changes my state of mind, you know, whether it be people, places, or things, like I said, you know. So I would go on these retreats, and I'd spent a weekend, actually 5 days, with 400 men on the mountain in North Carolina. And I finally thought I had figured things out. I thought I was able to connect to source. And I stayed on that spiritual high for about 3 weeks. I wasn't using, I didn't drink or anything. And then one day I decided to drink, and it totally kiboshed all of that stuff. I'm like, so what is keeping me from making connection to source or to this power greater than myself? You know, and it was the alcohol, and it was the drugs, it was the spirits, you know, in the Native American beliefs, when they talk about spirits, it's the spirits take away your spirit. That's what happens. It takes away your spirit. It takes away your connection to the source. And this was what was stopping me from growing and moving forward in the work that I knew I was called to do. I'm a man of service. I'm here not only to help myself, but I want to help others better themselves, you know, and without getting my shit in order, I'm not able to do that. So, like Sergio said, I was starving for this when I walked back into the rooms of recovery after 32 years of just debauchery and destruction. I was done. And today I'm willing to do whatever it takes to get this, to have this, and to maintain this. I would have walked from Fort Lauderdale here if I had to make it to this retreat today or this weekend. It doesn't matter. I would do that. I love the brotherhood here. I can't believe how blessed I am to walk in to the Westside Men's Group. And I was like, this is where I belong. I know that. This energy, the love that was there, the men that were sitting in those rooms, the stories that I was hearing, was exactly what I wanted and I needed my whole life. Men need men. You know, men sharpen men, you know, and I needed that accountability. I needed somebody to call me out of my shit when I'm in my shit. I've been fortunate enough. I was sharing in, like Sergio said, they invited me to be part of that Monday night small group. And what a beautiful gift that is. And I was sharing with Paul yesterday, it's like, maybe in the small group, I feel ashamed sometimes because my life is so good. Why do I feel ashamed because my life is good? I don't get that. That's the disease in me. Dis-ease. That's what it is. It doesn't want to be, comfortable. It wants to be at dis-ease all the time. It wants to cause chaos. It wants to cause misery. It wants me to die. It wants me to cause chaos and destruction wherever I go. It's been a true blessing. I have found that connection, and I've been able to connect to source finally and truly. You know, I get up in the morning and I do my prayers and meditations just like all of you do, or all of us strive to do. I'm involved in nature-based practices. That's how I pray. I go and I sweat and I connect to source. You know, I see how it works for me and I see how it works for other people. You know, I see how connecting to God and praying to God, how you guys do to whoever your God is or whoever your God is or whoever your God is, that's what works. We're all here for the same reason, to help one another become better human beings. I mean, ultimately, my higher power just wants me to be the best version of me that I can be. And sometimes that comes in very small increments, and sometimes it comes in huge growth. But I'm happy with both. You know, sometimes if it's just me not having road rage for the day, that's fucking progress. You know? If it's just me smiling at somebody one day, and that's all I did was just smile at somebody and have them smile back at me, that's okay. That's simple growth. That's all right. That's what we're here for. Just, you know, we talk about progress rather than perfection. I'm a perfectionist, and I'm a control freak also. You know, when I licensed as a contractor, I chose concrete construction as my trade because I was an egomaniac and I got one chance to get everything right. I need to be in control of fucking everything for it to work, you know? And it made me a person that was unapproachable because of that need to try to control every place, thing, person, orchestrate every single thing. Today, I want to be the person that's approachable. I want to walk with love and compassion in my heart. You know, when you walk into a room and you meet an individual that's just carrying the energy and you want what they have, that's what I want. I want what you have. I want to walk with that so I can give that to other men. This program's a gift, a beautiful gift. If all I have to do is complain about fucking some stupid asshole driving and me gaining 15 pounds because I got fucking sober, my life's pretty good. You know, that's, what do they call that? Sobriety belly or rich man problems or whatever, you know, that's, if my life, if that's the worst thing I have today to complain about, life is good, you know, and I owe that to you men. I owe it to you men for allowing me to be part of this, you know, come into these meetings, come into these retreats, learning how to work on intimacy. I don't know how to be intimate. I'm still working on a relationship with myself, trying to find out who I am. I can't be intimate with you if I don't even know who I am, you know? So as I do the work, I'm just peeling back the layers so I can do the fucking work, you know? And just like the cliches and the sayings, you know, more will be revealed, you know? So I was sitting a couple years ago, I was sitting in an ayahuasca ceremony, and when you go into something like that, you have an intention. And that was my intention, was please pull back the layers to allow the work to begin. Because I didn't even know where to start. I didn't know where my pain was coming from. I didn't know any of this stuff. And that's still the work today, is I'm peeling back those layers. Finding out, okay, this is this character defect. This is this character defect. This is how I can change this. And if I don't know how, then I surround myself with men that know how. And they share their wisdom with me, and I'm able to grow. I'm not going to share much more than that. I think I'm going to cut it kind of short and leave the heavy hitter come in. Appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Miguel.
Yeah.
Found member of the West Side Men's Group.
Nice.
I usually go in that. I'm also a member of the BCIC. Everybody knows I'm not doing that. It's an honor. Thank you for asking me to do this. I like to stay in the solution. So I'm not going to go into a whole, you know, backstory, drug log. I will say that I started drinking and using it at an early age, which led to, problems with the law. Which led me to doing some, starting off with jail time and then eventually some prison time. I was born in New York, but I was raised here in Florida, went to school here in Florida, and started to get in trouble here. And like any good alcoholic, I figured, you know, a geographical change. So I wound up back in New York, and This weekend has had got me thinking a lot about, because I'm not one, I've said this before, I'm not one to blame a lot of what's going on in my life on my past. But after talking to a few gentlemen here, there's something to be learned from it, you know. I realized that, you know, there are some things that happened in my life as a young man that kind of shaped the trajectory of where, what I did. And one of them was meeting my father for the first time. That was a huge disappointment. And I spiraled right after that, it hardcore on the streets of Manhattan, selling drugs to support a habit, which led to my first bid. I came home. I stayed out about 6 months before I went back to what I knew how to do, even though I did it poorly. I was selling drugs, wound up selling to an undercover, broke my parole, and wound up with 3.5 to 7. And I feel very fortunate, even though I was, so a 3.5 to 7 bid is a pretty, what we call a skid bid. You know, it's a small bid, you know, usually home and whatever. But when I got to the medium facility, there was a work stoppage that had been, already planned when I got there. And I got caught up in this work stoppage as one of the ones who organized it. And before I knew it, I didn't even get a month in that medium facility before they shipped me to Dannemora in New York, where dudes are doing 15 and better. And I became a believer real fucking quick. Like, holy shit, like, what am I doing here? And it got real, real quick. And I saw a lot of violence, and I learned how to mask that violence or that fear of what was going on with you know, a bravado and a lie, basically, that nothing mattered. It didn't matter to me what you were going through or what you have to go, or what I have to do to you to get what I need. And all that just kind of hardened my heart. Even though inside I was still very emotional and very sensitive to a lot of different things, I just didn't show it. I didn't let you see it. So I came out and I figured another geographical change would help. So I came back down here to Florida because I still had some family down here. Problem was, I brought myself with me. And I didn't change my thinking, so my behavior stayed the same. I was working in North Miami Beach at a tattoo studio. By the way, I'm a tattoo artist, in case you thought I was a gynecologist or a brain surgeon or something like that. I get that all the time. This is not an excuse, but back then the tattoo industry was not cohesive with sober living. Today I'm very fortunate to have been able to change that through God moments and God stepping in. But back then at 11 o'clock in the morning, I'm doing shots to steady my hands so I could work that day. I had a cool styrofoam, large styrofoam cup full of beer right next to my station. I would smoke on every break. And if the sessions ran late, I was, snorting and sniffing and smoking whatever was there to keep it going. And as long as the tattoo came out okay, nobody gave a shit. It was okay. It's just the way, oh, that's Miguel. He just drinks. That's just Miguel. He parties. And I owned it. I owned it. And I ran with that. And then it was like, you know, that's just who I am. If you don't like it, go somewhere else. And that went with everybody, with people that, you know, with my clients, with my bosses, who were usually worse off than I was, relationships with women. This is what I do. And if you don't like it, kick rocks. And I lived like that because I just thought that's the way it was. That's just what I do. It was working. I didn't listen to what you were telling me, even though you were telling me I look like shit or I'm a wreck or whatever. I didn't believe it, so I just kept on doing it. So I'm driving back from North Miami Beach, and I pulled a Huey right in front of a cop that I didn't even realize was there, less than a block away. I wind up getting a DUI with possession in my pocket. It locked up down here. They offered me 5 years probation. I knew I shouldn't take it because I could never stay on probation. But I took it because I had recently got married and I had a daughter, I had a young daughter, and I had just bought a house. And I did want to be that absent dad. So I took the 5 years probation. I couldn't stay sober. I couldn't, you know, because I wasn't allowed to drink. I wasn't allowed to use drugs. And to me, there was no way of doing that. So I had to try to beat the system. I would take the drinks. I would strap stuff to my private parts with clean urine. You know, I'd buy urine from guys and then I'd strap it there. And I did everything I could possibly do to get around not using it. Until the final time when I pissed dirty and I could have won an Oscar for the performance I put on in that woman's room and in her office, because I was like, this is bullshit. There's no way. Get another test in here. I've got more urine. I'll take another test. You know how hard I've been trying to stay sober and blah, 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 blah. And she's like, calm down. Fuck. Sometimes these things happen. You know, we'll send it out to the lab. And if it comes back like you say, then there's no problem. And all I heard her saying was that she's going to send it to the lab, which meant that she wasn't going to lock me up right then and there. So that night, I was on a plane to New York. Gone. Packed a bag, packed a heavy coat, and I just bounced. And I bring that up to talk about the insanity of my thinking. Because I'm learning today that this disease centers in my thinking. My thinking is fucked up. It was completely in my wheelhouse to leave my family, lose the house, and figure it out later. Just keep it rolling. And like a good manipulator, within time, I was able to find an apartment that was right across the street from the tattoo shop that I was working at, 3 blocks away from my daughter's school. And eventually, I had enough money to bring them up, relocate, and it was totally fine. Who needs a driver's license anyway? I walk to work, walk my daughter to school. It's only 3 blocks. No big deal. I don't need to drive. I don't need a bank account. Put it in my wife's name. Fuck it. No big deal. Who cares? Because they had taken my driver's license, and I couldn't drive, not legally anyway. And I lived like that on the run for 12 years. Tattooing is a cash business. And I would tell my employer, listen, don't file for me. I'm not going to file. It's free money for you. And that's how I lived. I lived like that for 12 years. And it didn't even come into the thought process of that maybe I should change the way of what things I'm doing. No, it was just, well, this is how it's going to be now. I'm an outlaw. Fuck it. Outlaw life, baby. And I continue to do what I do, which was drink and use and do tattoos. And I lived like that for 12 years. Eventually, I moved to South Carolina. From South Carolina, one of my family members died. I wound up having to come down here. I honestly came down here because I knew she was going to send me some money. Straight up. I lied to myself and said, I got to go down there and help her with her affairs. Yeah, no, I was her favorite nephew and I knew I was going to get some money. But when I got down here, somebody else had gotten involved in my aunt's business, in her money. And that person knew about the warrant. And she made a phone call. She called in a favor, had me picked up. I had to move my whole family back down here. My daughter was in school. I had dropped her off at school. They waited till I got out of school after dropping her off, and they pulled me over. And it was a warrant officer, and he was like, is your name so-and-so-and-so? And I was like, yeah. He's like, you got a warrant for you? I was like, yeah. And that day was one of the craziest things was that day I did not have a cold beer in my styrofoam cup that I usually don't get in the car unless that's full. And I didn't have any drugs on me. So I didn't catch a new charge. Thank God. And I wound up having my first spiritual awakening going back to the Conti in the same holding cell that I was in 12 years prior. Seeing the same guard in the same fucking pod, still working, still doing his thing. It's the same little lady that comes around and asks if you want to be anybody want to be a part of the spiritual dorm? And I raised my hand real quick because I knew if I did that, I'd probably get a rat quicker. But thank God that happened because I wound up in the spiritual dorm where it's not really like jail. It's a little nicer. It's a little different. Usually guys are trying to wait for a program or they're trying to get a mitigated sentence or something like that. And that's where the West Side Men's Group were bringing in meetings to that pod. And that's where I heard the message this time. And I was beaten into submission, like they say. I was desperate for something. And guys like Larry Binder, guys like Happy Bob, guys like Scott, my sponsor Mark, these guys were bringing in meetings into the jails and they offered me hope. Their stories were completely different than mine, but I related to the desperation and remorse and guilt and demoralization that they talk about in the book. And I was like, wow. I was like, and then they told me how they, these are guys who lost businesses and got their captain's license back and got their lives back and their families and their children and all this stuff. And they got it back and they gave me hope. And that gave me hope. And so there was like one big book in there. This was before I went to the SAP program. And there was like one big book in there, and I destroyed that book, man. I treasured that book. And I'll tell you, because Stan is here, I got to tell this story. So I'm in there waiting to go to SAP, right? And this kid comes up to me. He goes, "Hey, you need a lawyer?" I was like, "Yeah, I need a lawyer. What do you mean?" He's like, "Yeah, go talk to my lawyer. He's on the phone." I was like, "What?" Because in there you got to pay for the phone. You know, you need the money on the phone and stuff. And somebody just go use the phone. That's weird. And I'm like, what's the catch? He's like, no catch, man. Just go talk to my guy. So, okay, I get on the phone. I said, hello. He said, yeah, my name is Jeffrey Bloom. I used to be a prosecutor for Broward County. Now I'm taking on defenses. What's your name? I give him my name, and he types it in. And he's like, this is a 12-year-old warrant? I was like, yeah. And he's like, for possession of VOP, possession of cocaine? I was like, yeah. He's like, you go to court next week? I was like, yeah. He's like, I'll do the whole thing for $1,500. Now, while I was out there waiting to get this money from my aunt that I thought I was going to get, I went to a lawyer to see what it would take to fucking deal with this thing. And I'm a 3-time felon, so the first thing out of his mouth was, it'd be about $4,500 for me to show up at your arraignment. Then we could talk about what it's going to cost for you to get this taken care of. And I'm like, okay, we're not doing that. So when this guy said $1,500, I was like, great. He's like, you got any family out there? I was like, yeah, my wife and my daughter's out there. He's like, I can get a job. He goes, great. So I'm going to do one better for you. I'm going to show up at your arraignment. Bring as much as you can, and we'll go from there. So I was like, cool. So I go to my court date. Sure enough, this guy shows up. And all I had was a truck. I had a Jeep, and I was trying to sell it. And I couldn't sell it in a week. But my wife showed up, and I guess she said something to him, and he came over to me. He's like, yeah, I'm going to take your case. He's like, pay me when you get out. What the fuck does that happen? Never. Signed up, took on my case, and I've been in and out of the system for a while, since a while, and I've never had a public defender like not rush me into a deal. Usually they're trying to clear their docket. They're like, yo, just sign here. This is the best deal you're going to get, whatever. He didn't do that. He said, they're offering 33 months. He's like, but don't make a decision yet. We're going to put this off for 2 weeks. Are you open to a program? And I'm like, hell yeah, I'm open to a program, man. I'll do whatever right now. And he's like, okay, I'm going to have somebody come out and talk to you about a program. And I've heard that shit before too, you know, and you're sitting there waiting. Months go by and nobody's come. 3 days later, I get called out for the visit. And that man over there, Stan, ding-ding. And he starts to interview me for the First Step House. And I'm like, yeah, and I can get a job, and then my family's out there, and my daughter, and I just want to try this thing. And he's like, you'd be a great candidate for this program. I'm going to recommend you. And I'm like, fuck yeah, great, cool. Now I go back to, I'm going back to the court date thinking, okay, program. I'm going to the program. Sweet, right? I get there, and my lawyer comes over to me and says, you're not getting a program. And I'm like, no, but Stan's there. He's right there. He's going to testify for me. And he's like, you're not getting a program, man. I said, what do you mean? I'm not going to. Why? He's like, you're a 12-year-old absconder, dude. You're not getting no fucking program. I'm like, I'll take a monitor. I don't care. He's like, no, you're not getting it. So he's like, but they came down to 22 months. And those who have been locked up, you know, if your mindset is like you're going to program and then they hit you with 22 months, it's like, whoa, right? But again, he goes, listen, we're not going to answer today. We're not going to make a decision today. Go talk to your family. We'll put this off for another 2 weeks. Tell me what you want to do. So then I go back, and now I'm like, okay. And I remember about jail time and all the violations that I had. So now I'm adding up my jail time, and I got about like 6 months worth of that. I'm thinking 22 months. Okay, I got to go upstate. They're going to shave my head. I'll get a new number. I got 6 months gain time. Plus, they knock a third off. I'll probably be down in like 9 months on work release or something like that. And I bring that up to talk about the insanity too of how it's a normal thing in my brain that fuck it, 9 months, no big deal. What I do? I can do push-ups, right? I'll do that. Do a push-up, standing on my head, no fucking deal. And so that's where my head is at now for this next thing. And I go and I come in. And I'm in shackles, obviously, and I'm there. And he comes in. He's a funny guy. He goes, hey, don't go nowhere. I got to go somewhere in the next courtroom. I'll be right back. Yeah, okay. And he comes back, and he goes. Now, mind you, I've been going to the meeting. Well, I've been fortunate enough to be a part of the meetings that are being brought in by the West Side Men's Group and other organizations. And I really kind of just was hanging on to this hope, man. Like, because I had never believed that I could do. I never believed I could do it. I never thought I could live without drinking or drugs. And here it is, these guys telling me that I could do it if I was to follow some simple suggestions, right? So with me and my little big book, I basically did steps 1, 2, and 3 by myself in my cell, right? Check step 1, right? I'm an alcoholic. My life's unmanageable. When they tell me when I got to take a shit, when I shower, when I eat, when I see my family, they're managing my life, right? So my life's unmanageable, and it's a direct result of alcohol and drugs. Check, right? Step 2, came to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. These guys gave me hope. The guys who were bringing in the meetings to the jail. Like, if these guys could do it, maybe I could do it, right? Step 3, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I never was a religious person, but I did believe in a spirituality. I'm kind of leaning towards the whole universe thing because I feel connected and it makes sense to me somehow. And I basically just got down on my knees and I said, I need help. I don't know how, you know, I don't know what I'm praying to, but if there's something out there, I need some help. And I did that 1, 2, 3 in myself. And then I'm believing in this and I'm praying and I'm trying to grasp this whole program that you guys are talking about. So while I'm sitting there waiting for this guy, you know, my lawyer that I hadn't paid anything to yet and showing up for me 3 times, I'm in the box and I'm praying, man, I'm whatever, let's do this. And he goes straight to the DA's office, the DA's lady, and he starts talking to her. And I'm watching the body language. And at first, like, he's like this to her, and she's up here. And he's like, well, maybe we could give him a shot. And, you know, he's a nice guy. He really wants to do the program. And blah, blah. And she's all like, no, absolutely not. No, no. And he's like, no, but I really think he's believing this, and then he's going to try, and maybe we could give him a shot. And she's all like, no, no, fuck that, no. I don't like the way he looks. I'm thinking all this, by the way. It's not, I don't know what's saying. I don't know what's being said. This is all in my head, you know? I'm like, trying to figure it out. Like, I'm like, you know, praying and shit. And then his body language changes. And he gets up and he's like, now listen, I know you, Mary, and I know you want to clear your docket, so blah, 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 blah. And she's all like, what? No, wait, hold on. And he pounces on her. He's like, no, and now here, you know, this is your last chance because I'm not going to give those. And she's like, oh, okay, whatever. And I'm like, what the fuck just happened? I'm like, I don't know, something good just happened. And he comes over to me and goes, you're not going to believe the deal I got you. And I'm like, what? And he goes, I got your probation reinstated. I was like, what? Fuck yeah, no way. He's like, no, I had to do that to get you a fresh 364. That means jail times for none of you guys. That means jail time, not upstate time. And he says, and I got you a mitigated sentence down to 120 days when you finish the SAP program. So I just went from 33 to 22 to 5 months. If that's not God, I don't know what the fuck is. And I recognized it, like right then and there. I was like, that's this. And the jailhouse lawyer that's behind me goes, you better take that shit, man. Yeah, where do I sign? You know, where do I fucking sign? So I took the deal, man, and I still haven't paid this guy a dime. I sign up, and it's a couple days until I get shipped to the SAP program, and I honestly, I took it fucking seriously. I still have all the paperwork from the SAP program. I bought into it. I drank the Kool-Aid, y'all, you know, I graduated the SAP program. It took a couple days before I finished, but February 21st, 2016, which just passed, I celebrated 8 years, was the day I got released from the Conti. And one of the suggestions, because the deal I made with my higher power was, all right, I'm going to take all of these stupid suggestions that these guys are offering, and when this shit doesn't work, then I can say, fuck you, I'm off to the bar. Right? So I get out, 3 o'clock in the morning, they let me out, and my wife picks me up, and I had told her, yeah, I'm gonna try this AA thing, and da, 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 da. And she's heard me bullshit her like fucking a million times, and when I opened the door, the smell of weed just got wafted out of the car because she's a normie. She can do that stuff. And plus, she knows me. And now, mind you, I don't know if I told you, I got out with no probation, no parole, no ankle monitor, no UAs, no community control, nothing. Done. The shit that I was running from for 12 years, done. Finished in less than 5 months. So I could have went straight to the bar, no problems. I ain't got no UAs. I don't got a report. I don't got to do nothing. And she had one ready for me. Because I used to love weed. I still love weed. If I could smoke weed without the consequences, I'd probably be high right now. But I know now that one, I can't have one because I'm an addict. And if I have one, it's over. Done. So I went home. I took a 3-hour shower. I washed that jail off of me. I made breakfast for my family. And then I said, you're taking me to a meeting. And she's like, meeting? I was like, yeah. I was like, yeah, there's a meeting at the 101 Club. 12 o'clock and you're taking me. And she's like, okay. And I went. And because one of the suggestions was don't wait. Don't think you got another run in you. Go directly to a meeting. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Fucking go to a meeting. And that's what I did. And I went straight to the meeting. I went to the 101 Club. I didn't know anybody. But you guys said sit up front. That's where the recovery's at. They said, raise your hand. Tell people where you're at. Ask for phone numbers and a sponsor. So I was like, okay. So I sat in the fucking thing. And mind you, I'm fresh out of jail. And it came that time to me. So anybody's first meeting here? And I'm like, yeah, my name's Miguel. I'm an alcoholic. And I just got out of jail today. I'm looking for phone numbers and a sponsor. I said it just like that, too. I was fucking say something. It was, you know, I still had the jail shit on me. And I couldn't tell you what was said in that movie, in that meeting. But after the meeting, we did this little prayer. And people that I didn't know came up to me and they said, hey, here's my number. Call me if you need a ride to a meeting. I said, hey, here's my number. Call me before you drink. I said, hey, we're going for some coffee. You want to come? I was like, I don't got no money. And they're like, fuck it, we got you. Don't worry about it. And that was a big thing, too. You know, it was like I was taught, you know, you never trust nobody. You don't ask nobody for shit. You don't take anything without paying for it. But, you know, I trusted you guys. And I went out and had coffee. And you know, I was very uncomfortable. But these guys didn't want anything from me except for me to make it, for me to do well. So I didn't pick up my chip then. I waited till Thursday because I wanted to see these fucking West Side Men's Group guys. Like, was this shit for real? Because when you're in jail and they come inside and they look all pretty and they're telling these great stories and it sounds all good, back in my head I'm like, there's no fucking way. Bullshit. They're lying. I want to see this for myself. So I went to meetings. I start, you know, not, you guys recommended 90 meetings, 90 days. I did more than that. I hung around the clubhouse of another fellowship because I didn't have nowhere to go. I didn't have a job yet. I didn't have a car and I didn't trust myself. I stayed in the meeting, in the clubhouse, and I waited till the next meeting. And, but Thursday came around and my daughter goes to school at Plantation High School. So I made it down there and I picked her up from school and we hung out for a little bit. And her mom came and picked her up, and it was around 6 o'clock. And I wandered over to the parking lot. And as I'm walking the parking lot, I hear the laughing it up, giggling, chilling, having fun, laughing, having a good old time. And I see all the guys from the jail. I saw Scott, and I saw Mark, and I saw Lonnie, and I saw all the guys who would come into the jail and bring this meeting in. And it kind of just fucking brought it home for me right there. I was like, wow, this is real. They really do this thing. They're really here. And at that meeting, there, you know, in our meeting, it talks about, and I love the fact that I could say I am a member of West Side Men's Group now, and it's our meeting, because I'm learning that, you know, I just wanted to fit in. I just wanted to be a part of, you know. In our meeting, there's a point where it says, if you came here without a sponsor and you're looking for one, please stand up now. So I stood up. And at the same time, Mark and Lonnie go, I got him. No, I got him. No, I got him. I got him. And somebody yelled, Thunderdome or some shit like that. What's happening right now? I'm like, what is this? I'm like, what did I sign up for here? And as funny as it is, And it's, I think one of the other speakers talked about it. These are two men that I don't even know, and they're fighting over to be my sponsor. I barely even knew what the hell a sponsor was. But I tell you what, it felt good. Because nobody had fought over me over many, many years, except for me to get the fuck out. Like, Miguel, you gotta go. Like, you gotta go. And here's two guys I don't even know fighting over to be my sponsor. And I'll share this too. I don't know how much time I got left, but I had also tried this program when I was like 16. I've been in and out of rehab since I was 14. At 16, I remember going to a, going to an AA meeting, and I got the sponsor, but I picked the coolest guy. Picked this surfer dude. And I knew he probably smoked weed on the weekends, and then if I hung out with him, I'd probably get some girls together and this and that. And that was his biggest mistake, because he never called me on my shit. And so now I got Lonnie and Mark. You guys know, right? And I've told this story to Mark, so it's not like I'm talking shit. I'm like, I need Lonnie. Yeah, Lonnie's got a boat, and he's the cool guy, and I'll be going out on the boat with him, and we'll probably get some chicks, and blah, 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 blah. And Mark, I don't know about Mark. Mark's a little weird. Like, I wouldn't hang out with Mark right now. Not my kind of guy. Straight up. Right? And so here it is. I go up to Lonnie, and I'm about to tell Lonnie how I'm gonna let Mark down easy. Don't worry about it. Good. And Lonnie, first thing out of Lonnie's mouth is, listen, bro, you got Mark, bro. You got the best sponsor. You're lucky to have him. And I was like, no, but wait. And he's like, no, you're good. No, but wait. And I'll tell you what, thank God God does for us what we can't do for ourselves. Because Mark is still my sponsor to this day. And I couldn't have gotten a better sponsor. He's the most caring, loving, patient individual that I've ever met. He's deep in his sobriety. He knows his book. He knows his book knowledge. And he was patient with me. And we went through the steps. We didn't wait. And I love him to death. And he's still my sponsor today. And I couldn't have gotten anywhere without his help. I just took the suggestions that you guys offered, man. I kept going to meetings. I got an understanding of a higher power. I pray every day. You know, I just didn't drink. I just didn't drink. And then eventually things started to get better. You know, I got my license back. I was able to purchase a car. I obviously got a job. They fucked around, let me get a passport. Don't know why, how that happened, but it did. Today I own my car, right? It's in my name. I pay the insurance on it. That's in my name. I have my own little apartment, a two bedroom for my daughter. My ex-wife and I now were able to put our daughter through college. I'm proud to say that she's about to graduate this year. 4 years flew by like that. I've been able to travel. I've gone to London. I've gone to Paris. I'm planning a trip to Thailand because I want to get tattooed by the monks. These are all gifts of the program. The promises have come true. The biggest promise and that has come true, and the more important thing is my relationship with my family, my relationships in general. Like, I love the topic earlier about relationships, because I'm starting to change my thinking, and once I'm changing my thinking, then my actions will follow. And today I don't look to just manipulate and use people. That's not my first instinct, which that's what it used to be. Like, what can I get out of you? What can you do for me? The relationship with my daughter is like, I love it. It's the best it's ever been. I've spent the last 8 years doing my best to be a living amends to her and be present. Like, I was always in that little girl's life, but a lot of the time I wasn't present. I was that dad. It was like, what do you need? I'm busy right now. You need here's money. Go Daddy's got things to do. And Daddy's thing to do was to go to the bar or go to the club or go cop because I needed to get high and I didn't have time for you. And I've done my best to try to change that in these last 8 years by being present in that little girl's life, letting her know her dad loves her, letting her know I'm there and that she could tell me anything. Sometimes I wish she wouldn't tell me everything. But like I said, I got to take the good with the bad, right? But the fact that she feels comfortable enough to tell me anything and that I won't freak out because I'm a yeller, you know, I'm Puerto Rican, so I get fucking very emotional and loud and I'll bang things and I get violent at times. And today she knows that that won't happen. She could tell me anything and I'll deal with it because I'm learning how to deal with my emotions today. I woke up with untreated alcoholism this morning.
Wait, come on, dude.
8 years in, I woke up with untreated alcoholism this morning, and there's certain things that I do to treat that alcoholism. And if I do those things, I got a better chance of not drinking today. So I pray. I've learned to meditate. I read some spiritual literature. I talk to another alcoholic. I call my sponsor. And I go to meetings. And if I do these things, I got a better shot of not drinking today. And that's really it. These were the suggestions you guys offered me. And it's been working. So I'm not going to fuck with the equation. Thanks for letting me share.